We are going to pay a visit to Wisconsin's wildlife today, or at least a discussion of our Wisconsin wildlife. Find out who's waking up as the days get longer. Larry Mueller here, our guest, David Drake, a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. David, great to have you back.
Larry, it's good to be back. Thank you. Nice to see you again.
And it's great as well to see Jamie Nack. Been a while.
It has been a while.
So great to have you back as well. She's a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. So it's always great to have them come by to talk about our wildlife. And you can join in if you have a question or comment. I hope you will at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo, a question, or a comment there. And in fact, you should go to the Facebook page anyway right now to take a look at the great photo that's there from Lynn and Peter, who were covert cooperators in 2011, as a matter of fact. Scott Craven, well, you guys would know all about the Coverage Project, too. But they have a photo here of a river otter, and they're asking, it's a nice photo, they're asking how common are river otters in Dane County, or just in southern Wisconsin in general, I guess. And this one is carrying grass, twigs, or whatever. Does this indicate nesting activity, or is it just bedding material?
Well, first of all, hi, Lynn and Peter. It's great for that you are contributing to the show here. And they were Coverts cooperators a couple years ago. And Coverts is a landowner program for private individuals interested in managing their properties for wildlife. So it was great to meet them and have them for that weekend workshop. And, yeah, we have a river otter. Traditionally, otters were more abundant in northern Wisconsin, less so in the southern part of the state, and that is not necessarily the case anymore. They're becoming just as prevalent in the southern portion, so it is not uncommon to see otters in Dane County. And as far as the indication with the grasses, they do line their dens where they'll have their youngs in generally in spring at this time, April, with nesting material, grasses and leaves and things like that. So I think that's a pretty good observation and probably pretty accurate.
Excellent. And thank you so much for the great photo and the great questions. I really appreciate it. Well, here we are getting a lot of calls. And you know what? I think should we try a call? Let's see if we can get Don in Washington County on board here. Don, hi. Thanks for calling. Don, are you there? Or am I doing something wrong? Nope, we lost now. Let's go to Jack in Appleton. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Larry. Like your show a lot, and I appreciate you taking my call. I have a question about turkeys. I've been out scouting for turkey hunting, and I've been observing toms that are already strutting. I'm wondering if you can tell me what triggers the toms to start strutting, and are they actually breeding already?
That's interesting. Yep. David?
That's a very good question. And we have a phenology list on our door in one of our departments. We'll talk about phenology a little bit later on the show, but essentially it's activities that occur seasonally, and we've already had somebody put up that turkeys have been strutting, have been out of Mount Horeb. So typically what triggers all of this for animals, and we'll talk specifically about turkeys now, but it's animals in general, to start breeding is the daylight cycle. So as daylight increases, as we get into spring and summer, that starts triggering animals, their hormone system and endocrine system and things like that. That's now start time to either start waking up from hibernation, or in the case of turkeys, it's now time to start getting ready to breed and finding a mate and things of that nature. So typically, as day length starts to increase, so you get more daylight hours, obviously then it gets warmer. We get into a different weather pattern, spring rains, insect hatches, and all of that kind of stuff. And all of those things trigger waking up from hibernation, breeding cycles, things of that nature. But the main driver is the length of daylight.
Very cool.
Okay.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
Okay.
And for those folks who have a turkey,
it's coming up pretty quick.
Permit, yeah. I actually have one for the first period. So that's 1st of April or the 1st.
Youth Hunt is April 6th and 7th. I think the first period is immediately after that.
Yep. So looking forward to that. Turkeys taste pretty good. Pat in, in Rudolph, it's your turn. Hi, Pat.
Oh, hi. Thanks. This is so good. Yeah, we are sitting here watching through a patio door a squirrel building a nest in the chimney of a shed right outside the window. And I'm wondering what you can tell me about this. Is this just the female? How long is this? I know she shouldn't be doing that, but it's too late now. Mm-hmm. So when will we be able to, when will the nesting and babies be gone that we can actually do something?
So do you know what species of squirrel, Pat?
Like
it's not black. It's not real brown.
Yeah, so we're probably talking about a tree squirrel, but it's possible even flying squirrel. If you're seeing it during the day, my guess is gray squirrel, maybe a red squirrel. They'll have multiple litters throughout the year. So,
oh, good.
And as far as that doesn't mean they'll use the same den location. And at the point when they're finished with this litter, if that is in fact what's going on, you'll want to take measures to exclude them from using that that space again. So whether a chimney cap or some hardware cloth.
Yeah.
So that's something to think about. But as far as gestation, I would hazard a guess it's about 30 days roughly. Yeah. Just given the size of that mammal, the gestation period is probably around 30 days.
She has to come up a stair with this big ball of grass in her mouth and leap into a little maple tree and then get to the chimney and then go down in there. It was going on all day yesterday.
You know, I had an experience once in the woods. I was just sitting in the woods watching a squirrel, a mom squirrel, and she went up into the tree, into her nest. There's this big shaking. She comes out of the nest, and she's got a baby wrapped around her belly, arms around, paws around. She goes down the tree, goes over about 30 feet to another tree, climbs up the tree, and puts the baby in the new tree, which, as far as I could tell, looked just like the other tree.
That's a pretty common behavior for squirrels, Pat, who are not nesting in your attic, that when they have natural nests, it's big leaf nests in trees, and squirrel nests are called drays, D-R-E-Y. And once the litter is born, they will commonly move the litter from dray to dray.
Oh, good.
So there you go. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. It's probably more than 30 feet. It was maybe 50 feet.
Those are the rich squirrels that have a lot of different houses.
And there were, I forget how many, there were at least three. Anyway, you can join in, by the way, if you'd like to, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call, shoot us a question or an email on my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. And Joan in Williams Bay, let's go to you next. Hi, Joan. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. Before this last snowstorm in Williams Bay, I was walking by the Lake Geneva, and I with my dog, and I saw a dead bird on the like a little terrace, you know, by the police station. And I thought at first it was a rock because it was big, you know, like as big as a turkey. And I noticed that, you know, it was dead, and its beak was, you know, just down into the cement, you know, the wall. And it was beautiful. It had beautiful gray soft feathers and a black head and neck, and a yellow beak. And I took a picture of it. And I've been asking around if anyone knows what kind of bird it was. And one suggested a coot. Have you ever heard of that? And what do you think my bird is?
I think that's a very strong possibility. That would be slate gray in color. I don't know if you had a chance to look at the feet, but coot are a duck.
No, I couldn't look at the feet.
Okay. Well, they're a duck-like bird, and they have semi-lobed feet. So they're somewhere between a perching bird with no webs and a duck that has webbing. And so they have very unique feet. We'll leave it at that. Mm-hmm. They're pretty interesting, but they are gray. They do have that black head, and they do have a very conspicuous yellow beak. And they would be the size of a mallard.
Yeah, so I'll just add, I agree with Jamie 100%. The only other thing, if it really, Joan, was the size of a turkey, the other option, this black bird, but they don't have feathering on their head, is a turkey vulture.
Yeah, that's what I was
possibly
thinking too.
But
they don't have feathering on their head, though.
No, they don't have feathering on their head, but they're a big black bird, and they would be roughly the size of a turkey.
Yeah.
Right. The head was soft, and it didn't look like it had feathers on it. The body had the gray feathers, and the black was like velvet, you know. It was just gorgeous.
Well, if it didn't have feathers on its head.
Yeah.
Have you got that picture? Can you send it to my Facebook page?
Sure.
Why don't you put it up on go to the Larry Mealer Show.
How do you spell your last name, Larry?
It's M-E-I-L-L-E-R.
Okay.
And if you go to the Larry Mealer Show, post it, and if you can post it now, we'll take a look at it right during the show, and everybody else will be interested. Yeah, everybody else will be interested in seeing it anyway.
Sure. Now, Larry Mealer, themarymealershow.com.
It's just go to Facebook.
Oh, I see.
And then it's the Larry Mealer Show.
Okay, I'll try.
All right. Thanks. Very much, Joan, and we'll keep an eye out. Rob Ferret, our on-air producer today, will be watching for that. And he also answers the phones when you call in. So if you have a question, give us a call. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. James in Oshkosh sent us an email wondering if you could speak a little on cedar waxwings. I don't ever recall seeing them before, but I had a flock of over, this is James in Oshkosh, had a flock of over 50 of them in my junipers yesterday. They pretty much cleaned up the blueberries, and then moved on. Where are they headed and how far north do they go?
Well, James, that's a very good question. Cedar waxwings actually are migratory bird species, so they leave our area for most of the winter, but they're also one of the earlier returning migrants, and so it's very common to see them. Sometimes you can see them as early as January if we have a relatively warm winter, but February for sure. And again, on that phenology list we spoke of earlier in the show, we've already had a sighting of cedar waxwings about mid-February here in the Madison area. And they'll stick around our area. They'll go a little bit further north as well. And this has been, I think, a really interesting winter. For some reason, we've had some very interesting birds here. I was mm-hmm. just out shoveling my drive about a month ago and looked up in our birch tree and had a flock of common redpolls, which I have not seen here in Wisconsin in the 7.5 years or so I've lived here, especially where we live. So it's interesting to see them. Waxwings, however, are a pretty common bird. They're, again, another early migratory bird that returns pretty quickly. One thing that's really interesting about them, they are a berry-eating bird. So they eat a lot of berries off of ash trees and hollies and junipers, as you mentioned in your post there. One thing that's really interesting about waxwings is they will eat berries, and as those berries ferment, so during the day when the weather gets warm enough to get above freezing, and then at night it freezes, and as this cycles day after day, the berries will ferment just like you'd ferment a grape for wine. And literally, the waxwings, as they eat these fermented berries, will get drunk. And you'll see them a lot of times flying and acting like a drunk bird, and it's kind of an interesting thing. This happens with some other birds that are berry eaters, cardinals and things like that as well. But waxwings are a pretty common bird here, and commonly are pretty drunk in the spring.
Okay, there we go. We have lots of callers online. Our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack, from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison and from UW Extension. I'm Larry Mealer. Rob Ferret, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jamie Knack and David Drake, our guests today from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Always great to have them along. Kind of filling in today for Scott Craven. He's usually here on the first Wednesday of the month. And And we're trying to sort of get them on a regular basis at other times of the month, too. But they're filling in for Scott today, and we're hoping that we can get them on another day on a monthly basis, too. They have a quiz question for you today, and we're going to pick three winners at random from all the correct answers. And the three winners will each receive a copy of the book Writings Inspired by Nature by Jens Jensen. Very cool. You have to email your answer to talk@wpr.org. And when you do that, put quiz in the subject line and also include your first and last name and where you live in the message. You can also call us at 1-800-642-1234 with your answer. But you may run into busy phone lines, so that could be a problem as well. Here is the question. I want you to identify by common name the bird. Let's see. Let me get this set up here. The bird that makes this sound. There. Wow. Should we play it once more?
Let's play it one more time.
Okay, put your thinking cap on as you listen here. Wow.
All right,
there you have it. Give us a guess, and again, to guess, you can go to email your answer to talk@wpr.org. That might be the simplest, because the phone lines are probably going to be tied up. 1-800-642-1234. Keep trying on the phone lines, 1-800-642-1234. We get several answers correct. At least three people are going to win a copy of Writings Inspired by Nature by Jens Jensen. Bernie in Wauwatosa, thanks much for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I heard the squirrel story earlier, and I've seen this two times in the last couple of years where a baby squirrel fell out of the tree. I see this when I'm walking my dog. And the mom came running down and rolled it into a ball with her front legs and her chin and put it in her mouth and ran back up the tree.
Ah! That is very cool.
And I've seen it twice, so I know I wasn't dreaming the first time. That's really cool. I just wanted to share that.
Oh, thanks, Bernie. David, a comment?
Well, a lot of animals, they don't have baby Bjorns and other things that we would normally carry our human babies with. So they've got to use their mouth and what's available to them. So a lot of animals will grab their young by the scruff of the neck and carry them from location to location. And or the young, as Larry has mentioned, the young will grab a ride with the parent by hanging on to either the belly or the back or something like that. Or if, in the case of a possum, it might hop into the pouch. And so animals are pretty creative in how they protect their young and make sure that they perpetuate the species.
Very cool. Thanks again, Bernie. Joe in Springbrook, it's your turn. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
We feed the birds regularly, and squirrels a little bit, but we identify the birds that come to the feeder. But we've had one strange one that we've had in the past week, a flock of red poles has come off and on in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one bird amongst them that looks the same size and shape, but it's totally white, except for it has the very red, spot on top of its head. It has a yellow beak. It doesn't have any black underneath its chin. It's all white, except it does have black on the tail and black on the ends of the wings. And otherwise, it just seems to be coming back and forth as that flock of red, more typical red poles with the red top and kind of the little rosy chest. They come and go.
Yeah.
We've asked other people. We don't know what this is.
Joe, that's a good question. I'm going to wage a guess that it is a just a white version of a red poll. And animals,
like a piebald version.
The piebald version or leucism is just an idea where animals don't have the natural pelage color or coat color you would normally expect because something is mutated in their genes as that color is getting laid into the feathers. And so typically we don't see a lot of animals like that simply because they, as you mentioned, they don't blend in and they're very easy pickings for predators. Right now, that animal may be benefiting because we've got so much snow down that it's actually benefiting from the white of its feather coat is blending in with the white of the snow. But once that snow starts melting and we get a lot of green coming back, that that animal is going to be an easy pick for a predator.
Yeah, there you
go. Yeah, that was kind of our guess. That a true albino would be all white, I would assume.
Yeah.
Well, a true albino has, so they're white, a white coat, but then they also have pink eyes and pink nose. So an animal that has just white, like a piebald, what's called piebald, that they have a white coat, but they don't have that pink, the pink soft membranes like eyes and nose and things of that nature.
Very cool. Thanks, Joe.
Appreciate it.
Get a picture of it. Get a photo.
Yeah,
I'd love to
right.
see a photo of that one. Carl in Brookfield. Hi.
Hi. Love the show. I tune in every first Wednesday to hear these talks, so I really appreciate the show. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
We've got some land, about 6 acres, up in Lac du Flambeau. And my son and I want to make it a little bit more accommodating for wildlife. And I was wondering if there are any organizations that we could contact to help us facilitate that.
Okay, where's your land again? I'm sorry.
Up in Lac du Flambeau, Wisconsin.
Okay, Lac du Flambeau. All right.
Well, hi, Carl. That's a great question. I guess the first question back to you is what kind of habitats do you already have or what is comprised on the property?
Well, right now it's a lot of very old large leaf aspen, and below that has got an understory of some oaks and some maples, but it's all kind of a monoculture, and the aspens are kind of at the end of their range now, so they're all dying out, and just wanted to see if I'm a big grouse hunter, so if there's some way I could, and we do have turkeys in the area, and I was just wondering if something else that we could maybe cut, make some clear cuts or do something and get some ideas of what we might be able to do for a little diversity.
So with private landowners, we mentioned that Coverts program at the very beginning of the show, and that's a private landowner workshop that David and I and Scott Craven helped put on, and it's exactly for this purpose. It's for private landowners interested in managing wildlife, and we can talk about that later, or you can just Google the Wisconsin Coverts Project to find out information. But aside from that, the first thing you have to do is decide what species of wildlife you're interested in managing for. And that's because no matter what you do, no matter how you manage your land, you're going to help some species and probably shy others away from the property because of the options or the strategies you take on. So that's why I was asking you a bit about the habitat, and you put in a little bit there about some of your interests. And I would say that some things you would definitely want to look into is with the Rough Grouse Society and what suggestions they have in terms of managing that aspen stand. You said it was kind of beyond its prime. It's probably time to do some 1 to 2 acre openings, clear cuts within that property, perhaps even clear cutting a rather large chunk of that 6 acres. A lot of that will also depend on what's going on the properties around you in terms of a landscape level, looking at if neighbors are doing some harvesting, you might be able to get a forester in there or a logger in there, working together cooperatively with your neighbor. So I would definitely refer you to the Rough Grouse Society's website. They've got some excellent material there on habitat management, also some handouts. And the regional biologist is from Leona. His name is Gary Zimmer. And I would encourage you to send him an email and follow up with him. But in terms of wildlife in general, if you're looking for diversity, then you want to look for things like retaining dead trees, having brush piles, keeping fallen logs, diversity of nesting sites, so birds nest at all different layers within the forest. Some nest on the ground, some at shrub level, some high up in the canopy. So if you're looking at wildlife diversity, then you want to look at habitat diversity as well. So I would certainly be looking at creating some openings.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Very helpful. Could you spell that that first organization, the Coverts project you said?
Yes, it's the Wisconsin Coverts, and it's C-O-V-E-R-T-S. Wisconsin Coverts Project.
Excellent. Listen, I really appreciate your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I've a good friend of mine, Kurt Westbrook, did the Coverts Project, and really, we were on our way north on a muskie fishing trip, and he regaled me with stories and enthusiasm for several hours.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and everybody, all of the landowners that go through it are so like-minded that they learned so much from each other, what went right, what didn't go so right, things like that. So it's a really good workshop, and our workshop this year is August 22nd to the 25th. It's held at Kemp Natural Resources Station in Woodruff, and we're currently taking applications through June 15th. So, again, if you just Google that website, Google that name, you'll come up with more information, and you'll find yourself sending emails to me. So be happy to help you.
And it is a lot of fun for Jamie Scott and myself, too, because we get to spend 3-4 days up in the North Woods on beautiful Lake Tomahawk. But we also work with a bunch of very, very motivated, passionate landowners, and it's a great group of people to work with.
Sue and Poinette, your turn. Thank you, Sue.
Hi. A great show you guys have going today.
Thank you.
I live on the outskirts of small town of Poinette, and I've had a pileated woodpecker that's been around most the fall and winter and demolishing a couple of my cedar trees to wood chips. And but I haven't seen him for the last month. I'm wondering if he's off nesting somewhere or where he disappeared to.
Well, it is possible that they're out starting to look for mates and nesting areas and defending territory and things of that nature. But, you know, they are a rather good-sized bird. Obviously, this is the largest woodpecker species we have in Wisconsin, and a lot of people think that the cartoon character Woody Woodpecker was copied after the pileated woodpecker. So they've got a pretty good territory size that they occupy as well. And I would just kind of keep your eyes open and, more importantly, probably keep your ears open because they have a very distinct rap or drumming that can distinguish them from the other woodpecker species. And the other issue, because they're such a large bird and they've got such a powerful drum that they can really chunk a lot of wood out of trees. And they, you know, unlike other woodpeckers, when they hit the tree, they kind of hit it dead on and then they turn their head and they can chunk a pretty good size of wood, or a piece of wood out of that tree, each drum. So keep your eyes open for them, and they are a really, really neat animal to have around.
Yeah,
the kids have really gotten a blast out of watching them this winter, and it's always, my partner for a long time was like, there's no pileated around here, you're making it up. So finally one day I did get a picture and proved to everyone he does exist. So, but he does make huge holes in the cedar trees.
Yeah, they sure do. Yep.
Thank you, Sue. And as a matter of fact, we don't see as many pileateds in the southern. I mean, I can't remember seeing one.
Obviously, they're associated with you know, older growth stands of timber, and we have a lot of that up north, more so than we do down here. But they're starting to become, you know, somewhat common down in the southern part of the state, too.
Good. We have more callers online. You can join in, though, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Matt in Springbrook. That's kind of an area of the state I like a lot. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, guys. I got kind of a neat little story. Late last fall, I was checking some traps. Mm-hmm. And as I was coming up out of the creek, I kind of heard a distress call, kind of a distress sound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of looked down underneath this undercut bank, and there was a water shrew, and he had himself about a 2-inch green frog that he was trying to pull up out of the water. And I kind of tried to get a little better look, and I kind of ruined his meal there. But I was walking back to my truck, and it dawned on me: it's December 3rd. I just seen a shrew attacking a frog.
That is pretty unusual.
That is very cool. Is that common that a shrew will take on a frog?
Shrews are carnivores, and the water shrew is more associated with wetlands and wet environments. So certainly that would be a potential prey species, but that would be a pretty good pretty good battle there.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Matt.
All righty.
Our department has had a long-standing Christmas bird count route that is down in South Fish Hatchery Road over Nevin Fish Hatchery here in Madison. And couple of years ago. We were out usually second weekend of December is when we do this, and we saw a leopard frog out in one of the streams there. So it's a little uncommon, but not unheard of.
Margaret in Ironwood, Michigan, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Great program today. I just wanted to make a note. Our neighbor put his property, probably about 30 acres, into a conserve program, and they came in and they did a lot of, put it back into a wetland type of area. And like the person had said, they left a lot of deadfall and a lot of brush piles and, you know, things like that. It's right next to our farm, and we're just amazed at the amount of wildlife and bird life that we've never seen in our area that have come in. And so now we're looking into putting our back 40, we have a cedar swamp, and part of our west pasture into the same program, just because it's just been so impressive. We had a man come out, he's a local judge, but he does banding of woodcock, and he brought a couple of his pointers out, and my husband and I went out with him and helped him to band the woodcocks and the babies, and it was so much fun. And it was just the different waterfowl, and it's just amazing. So if anybody has the opportunity to do that with their land, it's really, really a great program.
Oh. Yeah, thanks, Margaret. And there's a lot of programs out there, from conservation easements and a lot of different cost share programs through the federal and state that can help with funding offset costs or provide rental payments to do conservation for wildlife in general. But you don't have to be part of those programs either. I mean, there are things you can do just on your own, as we talked about, with just retaining dead trees instead of cutting them for firewood, but actually retain them in the woods or the forest, and the brush piles and cavities, yeah. Providing artificial nesting boxes for a number of species that require cavities to nest in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how he had started out, was just that kind of, just doing his own thing. And then he got into this program where they actually did quite a bit of, digging out an old wetland area on his property and banking it and, so that it would flood. And they left a lot of the brush piles in that flooded area. And it's just amazing.
That's wonderful. Margaret, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. Sort of seeing things like that as happened to Margaret and her husband, I mean, that really does get your blood running a little bit.
It is. Everybody enjoys watching wildlife and having them around. So it makes you motivated to do a few things to encourage more.
That's probably the number one or one of the top recreational.
Yeah, wildlife watching.
Wildlife mm-hmm. watching.
And it's one of the major reasons people buy property as well. Yeah. So,
there you go. Roxanne in Peshtigo emailed us and said, I saw over the weekend a flock of birds not able to identify in my bird book. They looked a lot like female pine grosbeaks, but with a more brown-reddish head, and they had brown-reddish color on the sides and a gray-brown back. Couldn't get a good look at the beak, but it was fairly large bird and was eating seeds and things from the evergreen trees. First, I thought they were mourning doves, but they didn't have the long, slender neck of a dove. But they were about as big as a dove. Any thoughts, guesses? Gosh, it's hard to...
That's a hard one. I will, obviously pine grosbeaks, the male and the female look pretty distinctly different. So maybe just make sure that you're looking at a female versus a male. The males are pretty distinctly red. The other one possibly is an evening grosbeak. And I know my parents live in central Minnesota, and they have just been inundated with pine and evening grosbeaks this winter. And that's a possibility. Oh. And again, you've got kind of a distinction between the male and the female there. So a lot of, eastern United States bird books don't always have either the pine or the evening grosbeak in there. So you may have to go online and look at that. Or if you've got a National Geographic book that covers the entire United States, you'd for sure find the evening and pine grosbeaks in there. But take a look at one of those two species and see if that isn't what you're looking at.
We were talking earlier about a listener's mystery bird at the feeder. I think it was a white bird. We talked about red poles. And listeners Barry and Kate both emailed to say that they thought it could be a hoary red pole.
You know, it's a possibility because Horis are white and they've got that red spot in their forehead, but Horis are typically further north. And it didn't dawn on me it could be a Hori because they are so far north. And, you know, Horis and common red poles will certainly flock together. That's a possibility, is to look in the bird book and see if you think it's a hoary red pole, but they are usually a much further north bird than the common red poles are.
Okay, but it's a yeah. I'm glad they emailed in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing to look for. Mark in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Larry. I always look forward to the cranes flying north, and this is the earliest I've ever seen cranes flying north. Wow. Middle of February, and I've actually seen a few of them in southern Wisconsin out in the field. So I was wondering if this is really unusually early or...
All right. Jamie, what do you think?
Well, Mark, I would say I was just talking to David because we do keep that phenology list in the department that we've had cranes back already for a full month here. So I would say probably not that's particularly... This isn't particularly early. In fact, they've been around for a while and starting to... stage and.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, okay. Yep. Thanks a lot, Mark. And Arlene in Gleason. Hi.
I have a question. People think I'm crazy. I was coming across on Highway 70 toward eastways, and I saw a black lab out in the field with a deer. I looked closer, and it was a pitch black deer. Pitch black. I went on a couple more miles, and there was another one. Have you ever heard of black
two?
I'm not drunk. I know what I saw.
What time of day was it?
In the afternoon. They were out in the hayfield.
Well, Arlene, we have long learned the lesson to never say never with anything. So the minute we say, well, that's probably pretty unlikely, we get a picture that verifies it, in fact, was a black deer and another one down the road. I personally have never heard of a black deer, a solid black deer. You know, certainly darker in color, perhaps.
Yeah.
Maybe the way the sun was backlighting the animal. But I know, you know, certainly there are piebald, which is a mixture of, partial
right.
albinism. But I personally have never heard of a record of a black deer.
Okay, but, I have a question.
Sure.
Or a comment. I happened to go and talk to some DNR guys, and one of the guys said, no, never heard of one. Another one said, yes, there are some up in the UP. That he was an older fellow. And, again, I know what I saw. I'm a country girl. I know deer. I've seen, you know, and I know the difference between a black lab and a deer.
Sure. No, we certainly understand, and that's why I haven't heard of records of them, and
okay.
Maybe we'll have a caller call in and confirm with
I'll bet there's somebody
past
else.
Record. Sure.
I'll bet there's somebody else out there who's seen a black deer.
And we don't think you're crazy, but don't tell anybody this story.
And Arlene, another thing is keep a camera on the passenger seat of your vehicle. You know, if those are deer, they're going to be in the area. So perhaps you'll get lucky and be able to snap a picture in the next couple weeks here.
Let's be honest. I was just going across the highway. It's just one of those things that grabs
okay.
your eye.
Yeah. Sure.
And you're not thinking of a camera. You just open your mouth and say, I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Well, thanks for sharing it.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Arlene. And our quiz is over, and we have quiz winners, and we will announce those winners in just a second here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension as well. David's been with Extension for a long time. Great to have them along. Thanks for listening in. We had a quiz earlier, and we have winners, Rob Ferret tells me. There are lots of people who actually called in with the correct answer. I know we have a lot of good birders.
We do. That doesn't surprise me at all. So,
and I'm going to say give you the answer, and then we'll play it again so you can listen to it again. The answer is Eastern Bluebird, Greg.
That's right. That's correct. And we kind of put that in there because now's the time. They are back, and David's going to talk a little bit about phenology yet too. But now's the time to get those birdhouses cleaned out. Your bluebird houses, get them cleaned out.
Well, there, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology says this about the eastern bluebird. Marvelous birds to capture in your binoculars. They're a brilliant royal blue on the back and head, and warm red-brown on the breast. Blue tinges on the wings and tail give the grayer female an elegant look. I like how they, I like their verbiage there. And, of course, the range includes Wisconsin. And let's listen to the Eastern Bluebird again. So now you get keep your ears perked. You're going to be hearing some of these bluebirds not too long, maybe right now. There you have it.
I don't know if people can hear the call, but the way it's described is they're saying cheer, cheerful charmer, but fast. Cheer, cheerful charmer. So try to say that fast 10 times, and that's the call that they're saying. Cheer, cheerful charmer. Cheer, cheerful charmer.
That's pretty good. I couldn't do that.
So and we on the phonology list we've spoken about a number of times already, we had a bluebird already listed in February 8th.
Wow.
So they come back pretty quick, too. And, you know, last year was a really interesting year. We had a lot of things happen very early in the spring because we had such a warm spring. And I don't know if you know, think back to last year, we had days in the 80s in March last year. So we, you know, everything was accelerated about 3 or 4 weeks ahead of schedule on the phonology list. And this year it seems to be a little bit more normal, what we'd expect.
Well, we had, as I said, we had many people. I kept Rob busy, I'm sure, with the right answer. And the winners are Barb and Terry and Susan. Those are the three winners. And Rob, do you have all the information you need? He's got his thumbs up. So the three of you will each receive a copy of Writings Inspired by Nature by Jens Jensen. So that's pretty cool.
Well done.
Well done. Well done. Marilyn in Lakewood, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have bird feeders out and love feeding the birds. And for the past month, I've had flocks of 50 to, I'd say, 150 pine siskins coming. And there's a lot of them. When they come, they're all poofed up, and they land on the ground, and their wings are kind of droopy, and they die.
Oh.
And a lot of birds dying, and I wondered if you know anything about that.
Hmm. Well, Marilyn, I'm sorry that that's happening to your feeder. One of the things you may want to do is take your feeders down and clean them. And it's not necessarily that anything's going on at your feeder, but you also don't want to spread that to other birds coming. So you may want to clean your feeders on a pretty regular basis, maybe once a week, something like that, with a bleach water mixture. You know, with birds that flock together, like these siskins, for example, and this is also very common with house finches, where house finches get eye conjunctivitis, and you'll see kind of their eyes are all matted up with a secretion. You know, birds that flock together, because they do flock together and they're very social animals, if something happens, you know, to one bird or a number of birds, that can spread very quickly through the flock. But one thing you might want to do is just contact your local Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources office.
Okay.
And see if they would be interested in coming out and collecting some specimens, or perhaps you could bring the specimens to them and just have that checked out to make sure that there's not some kind of epidemic going on that the DNR and some other wildlife health experts maybe need to be aware of.
Yes, other people in the neighborhood have also said that they have dead birds.
Oh,
yeah.
Definitely.
Marilyn, I would encourage you to report that. About two months ago or so, I would say there was an email circulating around asking people to report that they were seeing some outbreaks of disease at of finches. So I would definitely contact your local wildlife biologist and let your neighbors know, too. But you want to start reporting kind of numbers and bring in a specimen or two that are freshly. You know, if it dies, you can go ahead and put it in the refrigerator or the freezer, but then get that specimen to them.
I have a little dog that goes out into that same area. Do I need to be concerned that it might be something that could be passed on to her?
Probably not.
I don't think so with the conjunctivitis and the salmonella, things like that we're talking about. But in general, you probably don't want your dog eating them anyway.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
He doesn't eat them or go near them, sure. But I wondered about that.
Typically, we will get calls occasionally about, you know, we have animals that are dying and what should we do about it and things like that. And, you know, if it's just one here and there, we typically say, well, that's just nature at work. Mm-hmm. But if you have groups of animals, you know, multiples of the same species, similar to what you're seeing in Maryland. We then do typically ask people to at least report it to the DNR and let them make a decision as to how they want to handle it from there.
Yep.
Okay, well, I thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Marilyn, for calling. And Sarah in Zion, Illinois, will turn to you now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. In the Kenosha paper today, I read about sighting of a bald eagle building a nest in Kenosha County, and that the DNR was going to check that out with an airplane. And I'm just wondering, is there really enough habitat down here to sustain? Because they're saying there's been a lot of sightings in Kenosha County. And, you know, how are they going to do down here?
Well, the eagle population has rebounded quite well the last couple of decades. There's eagles throughout the state. I've been seeing them as well, but they're migrating, moving through again. So along the Wisconsin rivers, and certainly ready to start nesting. They're primarily fish eaters. They'll eat carrion as well, so dead animals along the side of the roads. So I would say, yeah, there probably is the habitat to support their populations, and we certainly are seeing an increase in greater distribution of bald eagles.
Yeah, we have some nest building going on in the Madison, Dane County area. So
Wisconsin has actually done very well in conserving eagles here. And I think if I remember the statistic correctly, Wisconsin has donated eagles to 13 other states in the country to help them restore their eagle populations. And our eagle population is healthy enough that we've got a surplus and we can give some of them away to help other states.
Very cool. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Natalie and Toma, hello.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was looking out my window a couple of weeks ago, and we live in the country, and we're surrounded by cranberry marshes, and we get quite an aviary of birds in our yard. We have beautiful indigo buntings, and, oh, they're so neat. But all of a sudden, I was looking out the window, and I saw this huge shadow go over our yard, and a bald eagle landed right in our tree.
Mm-hmm.
And he was scoping out our field and was there for probably 4 or 5 minutes. Didn't see anything good. Flew off. But when you're used to little buntings and maybe a woodpecker, and all of a sudden you have this huge mature eagle in your yard, it was so exciting.
Oh, it is. We had one in a tree on our lawn on our lake home. And it was like, wow.
Yeah, and eagles are one of those animals where, you know, people just get excited about it. It's the national bird, obviously, but everybody knows what an eagle looks like, and they're not easy to confuse with anything else.
Yeah.
It's just so big. I mean, they were huge. They have been so close. I was just worried about my golden retriever. I thought I'd see her go flying through the air. I thought, no.
Your golden retriever's safe. Your poodle may not be.
Yeah, she's pretty big. But anyways, thanks for the program. It's awesome.
Thanks, Natalie. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Sharon in Minocqua, hello.
Hello?
Hi, Sharon. What's on your mind?
Sorry about that. I was just listening to your show, and I heard the lady call in about the pine siskins and a lot of birds around the feeders. So I just wanted to make sure people are aware. I'm Sharon from the Northwoods Wildlife Center up in Minocqua. We're a rehabilitation facility. And there have been lots of reports of certain types of bird seed that have been contaminated with salmonella. So people should be checking online or checking someplace to make sure that what they're feeding is not one of those that has been contaminated. Salmonella is also can be, you know, transmitted to humans. So people really need to be careful when they're cleaning their bird feeders as well. If they see the die-off of finches, especially. So it's good practice just to keep the bird feeders clean throughout the year, especially in the wintertime, especially when we get into this season of the thawing and refreezing. Finches will feed a lot off of the ground, and they'll be picking up a lot of different kinds of diseases. So I just wanted to make sure that the woman who was listening earlier does go ahead and change out her feeder and takes it down. The best thing to do with salmonella is to actually remove the feeder and leave it down for about a month. But people really also should be checking the bird seed as well as taking precautions to protect themselves and throughout the winter, to be cleaning the feeders at least once a week.
Yeah, that's a very...
Yeah, thank you, Sharon, for adding.
That is really good information. and really appreciate you adding to that. And so check your seed. Yep. And there's probably some information on what seed.
Yeah. Well, and another really good source to go to just in terms of what you're seeing at your feeders is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has an excellent website, both in terms of identifying birds through their All About Birds pages, but also about feeder placement, what to do if you suspect diseases and things like that. So a really good site to bookmark.
Thanks again, Sharon. Appreciate it. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and, of course, also with UW Extension. And they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Many of us who live in Wisconsin count our amazing wildlife as one of our real treasures, and we're lucky to have David Drake and Jamie Knack with us today. They are both from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. With us until 12:30 today, and happy to answer your questions. Maybe you've spotted an animal or a bird recently for the first time. Maybe you've got a little story to tell. Maybe you've got a question to ask. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And don't forget my Facebook page. I hope you'll go there. We've had some great photos already put up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we'd love to hear and see yours as well. You can also post your questions there. That's at the Larry Mueller Show. Back with our guests right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our Wisconsin wildlife on topic today here on the Ideas Net with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the University of Wisconsin Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them along. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in today. Questions about wildlife? I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to have you do that. And David, you were, we need to clear up one little thing that we brought up earlier.
Yeah, I hope I'm not getting paid today by the number of correct answers I give. but I just wanted to, I misspoke. Both pine and evening grosbeaks are in the eastern United States. There are ranges in the eastern United States, and they're also found in the eastern U.S. bird book. So I just wanted to clear that up, and I'm sorry I was confused with a couple other birds I was thinking about at the moment. So just wanted to make sure that the listeners are, that some of you are out there yelling, no, he's wrong. And some of you are out there, well, thanks for the good information. So.
There you go. Well, we had Bill send us a photo on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, a bobcat, close up of a bobcat that was trapped on their property in Lac de Flambeau. Thought it might be a 40-pounder or bigger. It's a really cool shot.
Yeah, that
doesn't look very happy.
No, that's a great picture. It even looks like it's been a bit submissive. So I assume that it is still in a foothold trap at that point, and they're walking up to it. They'll lower their ears and tuck their tails and show kind of a submissive posture. But that's a great picture. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And Marilyn had some questions about nocturnal animals bumping into their south-facing windows at night. Windows are just 18 inches from our deck where we feed birds and have bird seed. Could they be flying squirrels? We live in an oak savanna. Why not flying squirrels?
I think that's a strong possibility. I've been having lots of conversations with my parents over the last couple of weeks. My dad went out to put out bird seed, but he did it in the evening, which is the first time in a long time he's done it that way. And there were some flying squirrels on the platform feeder. So I told them, and you may want to try this as well, but put out a red spotlight. It's not as, it won't bother them as much as a big white strobe light. But to put a red spotlight out that you can turn on in the evenings of the first couple hours of darkness and see if, in fact, that's what's going on. I think you'll get your answer pretty quickly.
And let's go to Deborah in Milwaukee next, if I can get her online here. Deb, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was going to ask my mink question that I asked when Scott Craven was on, but I'm going to go for my original question. I have I always have my camera on me, and I got this picture last week of these crows. And ironically, it was the next day after the PBS had this
special on crows that they recognize people's faces. But I got this photo, and I wondered what they were doing. At first, there was like three or four of them, and they were, I think they may have gotten a bone that we put out for, like, an organic bone I bought for our neighbor's dog, Cookie, who wanders into our yard. And I don't know what they were doing. I thought first they were mating, but they looked like in my video, they were like, one was attacking. They were all attacking this one, and his wing was just sprawled out. And I couldn't see from where I was, and I didn't want to compromise getting the photograph. So they were, like, vicious, just vicious. And yeah. So I wondered what kind of bird behavior this was. Do you think it was mating, or it was food related?
Could be something else too.
Yeah, probably. It could be. Crows are a really, really interesting bird species. We were just talking on break about how smart these animals are, and they are very, very smart birds. So it could be crows are typically a mobbing type species, and perhaps they're interested in the food. They could be having a nest or establishing territory around there, and maybe the dog is or something is bothering them about the dog there. Who knows what it is, but they can be a rather aggressive animals. They certainly will, come and occasionally eat nestlings out of nests, for example, and they will mob, very commonly mob raptors like owls and hawks and things like that as kind of a safety measure. And so they can be aggressive at times if they have to be.
And I've seen them attack their own kind pretty, mm-hmm. if they've got an injured, if there's one injured or looks a little different. You're right. I mean,
there's lots of birds that will do that, yeah. and pick on the weak or the yep. inferior. And I'm sure it's an evolutionary.
Right. Yeah. Yep. There we go. Okay. Thanks, Deb.
Thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate the call. We have, here's another photo on my Facebook page. Here's another one. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and take a look at all the photos. Here's one from Zach of a radio collared American Martin.
Oh, we're getting some wonderful pictures of fur bears here. So the Martin is the only endangered mammal in Wisconsin. They were reintroduced a number of decades ago, and their populations are still struggling. Unlike the fishers that were reintroduced, their populations have expanded to the point where they can be trapped or harvested. So we're not that far along yet with the Martin. Still trying to figure out what's going on and doing some genetic work and potentially some additional reintroductions.
Well, we've got an assistant professor in our department, Dr. Jonathan Pauly, who's doing some research in American Martins. That may be one of his research subjects.
Oh, very cool. Barbara sent a note on my Facebook page and relating to the black deer, and she said, oh, yeah, from the Hayward area, I saw a black deer. Could not believe my eyes. I asked, and everyone, everyone thought I was crazy. So, you weren't crazy. And Zach from Northwoods Learning Adventures has another photo for it. Well, he says, Zach from Northwoods Learning Adventures, this is Facebook, conducts American Martin research in Iron County with the Mercer and Hurley school districts. The picture came, here's a picture that came from one of their trail cameras. And what have we got there?
Certainly looks like a wolf. December 22nd on the trail cam picture. It was -3 degrees out that night, or that day. It's 10 a.m.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's a pretty neat picture.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And Meg says, my parents in Mequon have had bluebirds all winter, and this past weekend saw two orioles. They have a heated bird bath that birds seem to love. And Rich sent us a picture of two of the children in his area who helped build bluebird houses. And there's a full story on it in the upcoming issue of the new magazine, Our Wisconsin.
That's great.
Which is a pretty wonderful. Cool magazine, too.
Nice picture of those kids, too.
Absolutely. James in Lake Geneva, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello there.
And what's on your mind?
Okay, well, I guess kind of a couple things. And the first thing is about squirrels and a show I watched years ago on public television about the 5-7-9 rule as far as how squirrels can jump horizontally, vertically, and everything.
Yeah.
And wonder if that has changed at all because just the other day I've had no problem with squirrel in my bird feeders at all. And I have 18 squirrels sometimes at one point. We have pictures of them. And they eat the bird seed that falls off and the corn that I throw out there. And all of a sudden, there's a squirrel up there. So I chased him off, and then I watched him jump from a tree, and I went out and measured it this morning, and it's 10 feet 9 inches. Now, is this just a super squirrel? Or
10 feet 9 inches.
That's what I have from the tree to my where the bird feeder he hits or when he lands. And I'm like, but it's the only squirrel. It's not like I have every other squirrel doing the same thing. It's just
that squirrel's had lots and lots of practice, I think. He's sure got his jump up to 10 feet. That's amazing.
And it may be a performance-enhancing drugs, too, so you may want to get it tested.
Well, here's what somebody else said. A friend of mine just built me a really nice squirrel feeding station for ears of corn.
Yeah.
The last couple of weeks, I mean, they've got all kinds of food. They never bothered my bird feeders before, and they really still aren't. I'm just wondering, are they getting so strong now that this one can now jump farther? But my question was, I wonder if maybe that 5-7-9 rule was just, I mean, that was years ago when I...
Yeah, that's probably just a general guideline, as most things are. I mean, I typically recommend to people to not have jumping off points, you know, 6 to 8 feet from their feeders. So one thing you can do is try to trim back some branches. If you're not interested in doing that, you're probably aware that there are some hopper-style feeders that work on counterweights, where when the bird lands, it's able to feed, but when the heavier squirrel lands, it closes.
Shuts it down.
So yeah.
Yeah, and he's jumping off a tree that's probably 8 inch diameter. It's not from a branch.
Sure.
The yeah.
This thing is going horizontally 10 feet.
I think it's fun to try to outsmart these squirrels. But another thing that you might try and get quite a bit of enjoyment is hang a clothesline between two trees and suspend a feeder in the middle of that clothesline. But before you do that, string some pieces of garden hose. Cut some old garden hose and thread it over that clothesline. And then in the center, hang your feeder. And when they try to run that clothesline, they're going to spin on that garden hose.
It spins on it, and he can't hold on to it. Because I designed a bird feeder here out of a fiberglass pole with four bird feeders that hold about 2 pounds of bird seed. And the squirrels cannot climb it. And they have just been living here for years. Like, we'll just eat what the birds throw down. And all of a sudden, one of now... decided that he can finally jump that far. I do have some other ideas. I'm going to work on some plastic stuff that maybe I can put on the one end of that bird feeder or that the hanger that I have to maybe distract him. But I do have another question that's more serious than that.
Okay.
Within the last week, I have found a raccoon and a possum dead in the front of my house. I mean, right up at the house, within 15 feet apart, and within a few days apart. I've looked at them. They weren't shot. I live in a 3-acre wooded lot, so they weren't, doesn't appear to be
by
a coyote or something. But I'm just kind of concerned because these are two nocturnal animals, and one of them, a possum, was 2 feet from our front door. And he just was laying there on his side. Dead.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, James, we're also kind of at the end of winter here, and those animals both tend to den up. They don't necessarily hibernate the whole winter. They'll wake and have periods where they're out on the landscape looking for food. But we're at the end of the winter, and their fat reserves are probably pretty well diminished. That these are animals that are awakening and in desperate need to find food, and they may be coming close to humans in order to find that food. So, can I say for certain what caused them? No, but that's kind of my guess, is that they're, again, out on the landscape looking for food, finding themselves in the area, and hopefully this was just kind of coincidental that you had two different species in the yard.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, James. You know, earlier in the show, Judy called and said she had this bird. We were guessing, trying to guess what it was. She found a dead bird, and
she got it up on the website, didn't she?
Yeah, I said, send it up on put it up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and she did it. And what do we got?
And with confirmation, David and I agree, it was an American coot, so... That's wonderful.
All right.
Yeah, so thank you for sending that.
Very, very cool. And here's one from David, who lives on Shawano Lake, and says and a great picture of a bald eagle was just off their seawall. He says, I've also noticed many sick and dead pine siskins this year. They visit the feeders with red poles and the goldfinches and house finches, sometimes over 100 birds at a time, yet only the pine siskins seem to be affected. They seem to be dying at extremely cold nights. I find them huddled on the ground next to buildings as if they were looking for warmth.
Oh, so, they could be suffering some kind of a hypothermia issue, you know, and maybe if they're not getting enough food or even if they're eating and that for some reason they're not converting that to good nutrition, that they're not able to keep themselves warm on those cold nights and they're dying from a hypothermia type exposure event.
Yeah, there we go. Let's turn to Bill in West Salem next. Bill, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, guys and gals. Listen, I got a log cabin in DeSoto, Wisconsin, and it's becoming looking like a demilitarized zone. There's so many holes in it, and I know what's doing it. Our woody woodpeckers,
yeah.
I call them the flying jackhammers. My question is there anything I can do, okay, other than, I do not want to kill them. These are, you know, because I've got all kinds of woodpeckers, and I love them. I got the pileated, I got da-da-da-da. So any suggestions there, folks? What can I do to stop them from pecking away at my log cabin?
Bill, the first thing I will do, I will direct you to a website that is relatively new, but it's a collaboration between the University of Wisconsin Extension and the DNR and a federal agency called U.S. Department of Agriculture and Wildlife Services. And the address for that website is wildlifedamage, all one word, .uwex.edu. And once you go there, we have a fact sheet up about managing woodpecker damage. So I will refer you to that, and you can peruse that, both the website and that specific fact sheet at your own leisure. But right now, one thing you may want to do is to have a pest exterminator come out and give you an estimate of that house and see if they find insects inside that house someplace or in the wood particularly. And if so, have them treat your house, because it is very possible, especially during the non-breeding seasons, that there, you may have some wood rot in there, even if it is not readily apparent. And the insects are taking advantage of that wood rot, and the woodpeckers are going after the food source. So if you can eliminate the food source, sometimes you can eliminate the woodpecker damage. So that's one possibility.
Okay.
Another possibility is to take some Mylar tape, or which is similar to like strips of aluminum foil, more or less, and you can hang that from your eaves. And you want to hang it about 6 inches off the side of your house and make sure it hangs low enough that it covers the entire area or hangs low enough to cover the area where the damage is. And a lot of times that will help discourage the woodpeckers from being there. And in some drastic occasions, you can take a piece of heavy tarp or heavy plastic like drop cloth you'd use for painting.
Mm-hmm.
And with a staple gun, just staple that up over the area that's being damaged in your house and leave it there for 2 or 3 weeks until you drive the woodpeckers off your house.
Uh-huh.
If you do that, make sure you're vigilant. And again, with the Mylar tape, make sure you're vigilant and you're not driving them to another part of the house that's previously undamaged. And if that's
right.
The case, you just want to make sure you've got more material at the ready to put in place so that you can keep driving the woodpeckers off of your house altogether.
Very good.
Lastly, if you're feeding suet or something like that that might be an attractant to the woodpecker, make sure you take that down.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's probably my source.
Okay.
and don't smear your house with suet.
No.
Yeah, hey, real quick, can you give me that website again?
Yes, it's Wildlife Damage.
Wildlife Damage.
.uwex.
U-W-E-X?
Yes.
Okay.
.edu.
.edu.
D-U.
Gotcha.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Lynn in Evansville next. Hi, Lynn.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, my call has to do with owls. I had kind of a remarkable situation this past week at night around midnight in my backyard. It sounded like a virtual hootenanny. I think they were barn owls. There was two hoots followed by the trill. And and at any rate, it was loud, obviously because of their proximity. They must have been very close to me. But also it was repetitive. It was like one was saying, I can be louder than you, and they kept going around this circle. There were three to four of them. So my question is what were they doing? I do have a bird feeder where there might have been dropped seeds in the vicinity, but I'd never heard. It was kind of, again, like crows where they flock.
Well, it's kind of breeding season, isn't it, though?
It is a little bit late for, you know, most of the owls will start breeding late January. They'll start actually nesting late January, early February, something like that. But owls, you know, we hear them in our neighborhood. They'll commonly call back and forth to one another, just kind of say, hey, how you doing? And I'm over here. Where are you? And things like that. And, you know, that we quite commonly hear, we don't really have barn owls, B-A-R-N owls. They're not terribly common in Wisconsin. And but we do have a lot of barred owls, B-A-R-R-E-D. And that barred owl, that call is who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. And that might be that trill that you hear, that who cooks for you, who cooks for you all.
Gotcha.
It kind of falls off. But we also have great horned owls, and that they make that call more of like a typical hooty hoot 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 that you'd hear. But we also, in the neighborhood setting, we've had screech owls in our neighborhood before, and screech owls have a whole variety of calls, but one is a horse's whinny, and one is literally a screech. You know, it sounds like somebody's getting murdered, literally.
Right.
And so you might want to just go online and listen to some of those calls and see if that's what you hear.
I can identify it. Yeah. I guess this a remarkable thing, again, was I have heard them at distance where one would call, there'd be a space. These were overriding each other.
Yeah.
So it was like they were staking claim or something. I can be louder than you.
Yep. Okay. They could be defending territory. They, you know, still could be trying to attract mates and things like that as well.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Glenn in Winona, Minnesota. Hello.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to let you know earlier you had a lady call in that said she had seen a black deer.
Yes.
Well, I drive truck, and I get to Wisconsin every 2 weeks, but I've never seen one in Wisconsin, but I have seen one in Texas. And I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and my brother does a lot of deer hunting in South Dakota.
Yeah.
And he's never seen a black deer either, but he said he's heard of other hunters say they've seen black deer.
So they're probably out there, Jamie.
Yeah, they probably are. Like I said, it's just not something I've ever heard an account of, but that'll be something.
I thought
that
there was a black deer. I mean, not here, but in.
Well, there's a black-tailed deer.
Black-tailed deer?
But they're out west.
That's a different species.
Yeah,
yeah.
Really different species. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
And certainly wouldn't find them around here unless they were a release escape from a
now you know down
farm.
In Texas, obviously they do a lot of deer farming. I mean, there's deer farming
deer
here in Wisconsin,
and
deer
genetics.
Breeding and
so
genetics.
That wouldn't surprise me to have black deer down there.
You know, especially if something, and then they have escapes occasionally and things like that. So that's a possibility.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Glenn, for calling. Appreciate your call. And oh my gosh, here we are out of time. Boy, it flew.
It goes fast.
Oh, it flew by. David, Jamie, thank you so much. We'll have you back soon, I hope.
Great.
Sounds
we'll look
good.
Forward to
thank
it.
You thank very you. Much.
We'll do it again. David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and the University of Wisconsin Extension as well. Great to have them with us. Tomorrow at 11, we'll get advice on avoiding fraud at tax time and find out Wisconsin's top 10 consumer complaints with a couple of Wisconsin's top consumer watchdogs. That's tomorrow at 11. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.